If you follow me on TikTok, you may have seen me hyping up this brand lately called Happy, spelled H-A-P-I, an acronym that stands for Humanity, Acceptance, Progress, and Intersectionality. I made a video recently showing off their patented drawstring lanyard-style mask and shouting out their cause. Now, I do a good amount of branded work these days, so maybe you didn't think much of it, but Happy is actually a special cause. Not only is the founder of Happy, Joey Plaskett, a good friend of mine from high school who I've known for many years, but the cause is one I put my full seal of approval and support behind. Joey created Happy because he believes in doing his part to help craft a more inclusive and progressive future. And he believes that one of the primary tools in achieving a world with more compassion, love, understanding, and inclusivity is empathy. And he believes that empathy isn't something you are simply born with, but it's a tool that you can actually learn how to utilize through careful practice. It's an active process. And because he believes this, he is partnering with the Be Kind Project to raise money to implement a curriculum based around teaching empathy skills to children in schools. It's a simple, elegant idea that could have a real impact on our future. Empathy is the practice of recognizing that the jerk who cut you off in traffic is a person having an entirely separate experience to yours. An experience that if you took the time to listen to, you'd realize you probably relate quite a lot to. It's realizing that people who hold opinions and beliefs and views that you find shocking or abhorrent obtained those views through a series of circumstances and lived experiences that were different from your own. It's a tool that honors both our individual lived journeys and our collective similarities all at once. It helps us recognize the fact that the uniqueness of our stories actually unites us and makes us more alike. Because everyone is someone. A daughter, a brother, a parent, a lover, a teacher, a friend. And we all usually experience various intersections of these identities over a lifetime. I know in my life that trying to learn how to lean in and relate when I want to pull away and judge has been a game changer. So for my money, I'm all in with Joey and this curriculum. And I hope he succeeds at doing what he's trying to do. From a Blankenfoot recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I'm talking with my good friend Joey Plaskett about empathy. But are you ready to go? Are you ready to do it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I think so.
Have you ever done one of these before?
No, this is the first time I've ever been on some sort of recorded program.
It's way less scary than rock climbing or mountain biking.
I think that could be subjective.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
Yeah.
You're like, go ahead and like let me free solo this boulder, I don't want to do an interview.
Yeah, and fun fact is that's actually technically what I used to do. Like the genre of rock climbing that I did was bouldering, which means you don't have any ropes, you land on crash pads. And the boulders that I sought out happened to be 20 feet or taller.
Right.
So if you fell, it was likely you were going to hurt. I mean, I fell all the time. That's probably why my knees don't like me anymore.
Did you ever get seriously hurt doing that?
Only once, and I wouldn't call it serious, but I broke two ribs. I fell and like kind of missed the pads. My spotters pretty much saved my life and threw me so that like I half landed on the pads and half off of the pads. And the half that landed off the pads, my ribs hit like a rock. And yeah, I fractured two ribs. It hurt to breathe for a while, but I didn't know they were broken. And so I literally like walked it off, like tried to breathe. And then I was like, I can breathe. This is fine. And I got back on the rock and then I climbed it and finished and topped it out and it was fine. And then like I drove home and realized that I couldn't breathe or move and was like, I really should not have got on that second time because
Nah, that's stupid. I mean, without that, then you don't have like that solid humble brag. Like you need that.
Yeah.
You need that story of like, I didn't know it was broken, so I just climbed the damn thing. You know, what can I say?
I just climbed it like an idiot, you know, but I did it. Yeah. I mean, everyone needs at least one humble brag in their life, right?
I've got lots. I've got plenty, you know?
I should try to cultivate some more of those for myself.
Yeah, like that story about like how I was a casual stand-up comedian in New York who like killed with this bit of impressions. It's like, yeah, I never was a successful stand-up and I never actually got good at stand-up and I like probably was actually pretty bad at it. But on a few of those open mics, people liked my impression of Lincoln Bradshaw. in Brooklyn.
I mean, that's still a pretty good humble brag because you don't have to phrase it like that. You just say, yeah, these few times that I did stand up in New York,
yeah,
you know,
right.
People loved this bit.
Yeah. And that's all they need to know. Those are the bare minimum facts is that I was doing stand up at some club in New York and none of that is a lie. It just happened to be like a basement bar in Brooklyn. And there were 20 people who are also other fledgling comedians waiting to go up and do their 5-minute set, and that's who the audience was. But no one needs to know those parts of the story.
No, why would you tell them those parts? I was impressed just knowing, hey, he did stand up in New York. Like I would never do that.
Oh man. Okay, well, but you would go into business for yourself and start something that takes a lot of personal and monetary investment. And that's what we're talking about today. That's also a very scary thing for a lot of people to approach starting something like this. Why don't we start out? Tell me a little bit about Happy and where like this idea originated and how you thought, you know what, I'm going to do it.
Yeah. So, I've been a business owner now for, I don't know, 8 to 10 years, which is kind of weird to say because it's not something that I ever thought that I was going to do. I'm a professional tailor. I make suits for a living. And this will be poignant to the conversation later, but we went to high school together and mm-hmm. nobody in high school ever knew that I knew how to sew or that I loved sewing. And that was actually because I was like, I was terrified of being ridiculed. I thought people were going to say that I was gay, which terrified me in high school.
Wow.
And so I didn't tell anybody. But so for now years, I've been sewing for 20 years now, just over 20 years. And I've had a successful business.
I just want to say real quick, I was super used to, by the time I got in high school, I was super used to people saying I was gay. So I learned early on. As a kid, like, oh, that's actually fine. Like, but yeah, I remember when we were in high school, like that was, and I think kids today in high school are like, it's not as big of a deal. But when we were in high school, it was like, it was really scary. Like you had to like be very protective of your masculinity and your image. And
100%. And I mean, back then it was kind of ruthless. Everyone was the culture back then was just 100% shaming people, at least maybe not 100%, but it felt that way. And so it was kind of scary to try to say like, oh, I like to do something that could be associated with being gay.
Yeah, no one was out when we were in high school. And and I mean, there were like a couple kids that I knew that were out and everyone else came out after high school in college and stuff. But yeah, like, I mean, I'm 33 years old and people still all the time are like, are you gay or bi? And I'm like,
yeah.
I'm like, nope, but I totally know why you think that. And that's fine. And like, I just am the way I am.
Well, and it's kind of nice to feel that way now, you know, like we've grown past that. We've seen that, you know, like we've been able to change culture, at least to a point where we can be comfortable. You know, it's like, you know what? I can see why you would think that I was gay, but like, I'm not, but like, maybe I'm actually kind of complimented by that.
So. I am complimented by it. I'm like annoyed when people are like, nah, I didn't peg you. Is like when they're just like, nah, you seem straight. I'm like, what does that mean? Am I like coming off to you as like aggro? Like, what is like, what? I'm like, I take pride in my femininity and my, you can't really know what I'm doing or what I'm about or like who I'm trying to get with. Like, I like that mystery. I'm
into
that.
Your therapist impression. Your therapist character.
Yeah, yeah. You're like, therapist. Don't even know who that person is. Like, people are like, no. Is it a woman? And I'm like, I don't know. I've never asked them. Like, I don't know what they identify as. I don't know. So, but that's very much like the space that I like to keep people in when they meet me. So anyway, you're after high school, like, I didn't know that you sewed in high school, by the way. I guess you just said like that was by design. Yeah, you didn't want people knowing that. But
my closest friends didn't know that I sewed in high school. Mm-hmm. And so like I finished up high school, you know, we all went our separate ways and I was going to be a physical therapist, but then I started small businesses here and there. And then I made this business making suits and it actually took off and I'm doing pretty well with it. Mm-hmm. And so, it's just kind of been interesting being a business owner, but in the beginning of 2020, last year, 2020, you know, we all got hit with COVID and I kind of had a unique situation happen where I wasn't, you know, nobody was buying suits. I was kind of thinking, man, am I going to be out of work? Like what's going to happen? And I ended up collaborating with Intermountain Healthcare, University of Utah, and the LDS Charities to help produce 6 million medical grade masks locally in Utah, which was really, it was kind of a cool experience. You know, I worked with all these really big people and I designed the mask that was produced and I sourced the fabric that was also used. And in the midst of that, I learned a lot about masks, like more than I thought I would ever know about medical anything, mm-hmm. like PPE gear. Like I know too much about masks at this point. And so what then happened was I kind of started just getting on my sewing machine and trying a bunch of different things. And I ended up inventing something which is now officially patent pending under, you know, I've got all the protection for it. And it's this mask that is super adjustable and really comfortable and really awesome to wear. And it was like, oh man, I can do a lot with this. And at first I kind of felt like Scrooge McDuck. I was just seeing dollar signs, you know? Just
yeah,
like,
sure.
Oh, yeah, this is going to be awesome. But
I will profiteer off of the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, any businessman is going to see that and like, and think, oh man, this is going to be good for me.
Oh yeah,
but
plenty did. Yeah. Influx in Bezos's wealth. Like people who are like, oh,
crazy.
Online shopping is going through the roof, baby.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. And
yeah.
So that was my initial thought when I finally, you know, I had submitted and filed for this patent and everything else. But there were a lot of other really impactful, you know, moments in 2020 that were indicative and just illustrative of what's going on in our society and how like divisive our current culture is, specifically around anyone who has been in quotes, you know, othered. We've got like the BIPOC community, we've got LGBTQ+, you know, we've got, I mean, even today women. And there were some really illustrative moments during 2020 and it got me thinking, man, you know, maybe I could make a lot of money with this mask, but what if I made a lot of money that made a difference? You know, like, cause I don't technically need more money. I would love to have more money. I don't think anyone would actually say otherwise. No one would be like, man, I don't want more right now. Like that'd be nice. But
I mean, I think
time,
that there's some people in the world who like should say that they're good.
Oh, 100%. They should say it.
They should say like, yeah, that's plenty for 20 lifetimes.
I mean, we just talked about Bezos, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, that's
he
yeah,
should,
that's
he
what
should
I'm
have said
at.
That years ago, but
that's
he
what
didn't,
I'm looking at. Like,
so.
you should be saying no. Everything else, everything from here on out, everything, every single red cent that I make is going to go to different charities and to my employees and to like every last bit of it. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I was like, man, what if I could make a difference? And actually the other day, my fiance said something that I loved that I think kind of sums up like months of me cultivating the idea and everything else. And it just highlights it really well. She said, as a woman, we shouldn't have to fight to have rights or respect. This shouldn't be a debate. People just need to stop being dicks. And I mean, it's kind of like she said it and it was just like, man, that is so true. And I saw that it's the same. And it's just a reiteration of a simple fact that right now, currently, equality does not exist in America.
Yeah.
It just doesn't.
Yeah.
That's just a fact.
Yeah.
And so, man, I had to do so much digging and research, and I called a bunch of nonprofits and everything else because I was like, man, if I'm going to make this money and it's going to go to the right cause, I've got to find the right cause. I've got to find somebody who's going to move the needle forward and make some sort of lasting change. And I found the Be Kind Foundation, and they have this curriculum that they teach the kids that is based on kindness and acceptance. And they touch on points of like ethics and society and like understanding the environment around you, which I think realistically is probably the most effective approach to addressing these systemic issues that are kind of pervasive in our society.
Yeah, my partner and I were just talking about this. I was like, I was watching a clip of Marjorie Taylor Greene arguing against this like equal rights bill that's going forward to like protect trans people. And like, I think it has something to do with like trans people in sports. I actually don't know what the bill is. I just know that Marjorie Taylor Greene was like adamantly against it and was like saying that it's like this evil thing that we can't allow. And then this other congresswoman who is a mother of a trans girl, trans woman, was like, well, I think my daughter is one of the bravest people I've ever met. And I don't like the fact that my daughter can legally be discriminated against in lots of states just because she's brave enough to be herself. And I was like watching it. I was like, God, people make it seem like it's so hard to just be, like you said, don't be a dick, but also like parents and stuff, like to just be cool with their kids when their kids come to them and say like, hey, you know, mom, dad, I got something to tell you about myself, or mom, or dad, like I got something to say about myself. It's like, I just was literally sitting there thinking like, if I had a child who was born with a penis and they came to me and said, hey, dad, I think I'm a girl, I think my first thing would be like, awesome. You want to go shopping? Like, you want to get some new clothes? Like, where you want to go? Like, it just like, or like, whatever. How do you want to do this? Like, what can I do for you? How can I help you? But like, it's, I don't know. Then my partner and I started talking about how would you implement teaching that in a home to let your kids know early on that like, we're cool with you finding your own path and your own identity in life. And that kind of like education of like, representation in stories, so that if you're teaching your kids or showing them stories with like diverse characters and diverse life paths represented, so that they can see something and go, is that something I can do? Is that like a life path that's available to me? And you go like, absolutely. Yeah. Like that's totally a life path that's available to you. And I think that's sort of what I'm hearing from you talking about the Be Kind Project, is it's about like trying to shape a future world full of people who understand these things foundationally and who don't have to work through years of trauma as adults to get to the basic understanding of not being a dick.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, you covered it perfectly. And the other thing is, like you said, it's, you know, if we're taking this curriculum and the education to the kids who will then grow up and have that idea of like, oh, you're just a human, mm-hmm. and I'm accepting you as a human,
yeah.
which, you know, it blows my mind. Like you said, that, man, why is it so hard for you to just accept that somebody identifies as something outside of your cognitive realm?
Right.
You know, it's okay to open up your mind and realize other shit exists. Like, that's fine.
Other people
and just acknowledge it and move on.
Some people think it's fun to climb boulders and put their bodies in physical harm, and some people think it's fun to do a podcast and be on very visible on the internet all the time, and those
exactly.
two people are both okay.
Yeah, and those two people are different, you
yes.
know. One has a beautiful mustache.
Uh-huh.
One wishes he could have a beautiful mustache.
One,
you know,
you've got some nice facial hair going on, and
you realize, I think I've told you, this is the only place it grows. I'm for those of you listening, I'm pointing at the perfect area of a bro tee. Like, it doesn't grow on my.
We
cheeks.
Have that in common, though. I have no cheek hair, so
yeah.
There's our common ground. You know, we can come
I mean,
together
that's perfect. See?
And clasp hands. over no cheek hair.
Yeah, so we're humans. And so that's who I'm partnering with to like, if I'm selling these masks, I'm donating the vast majority. I mean, I have invested a lot of money into this project already, like a ton of my own savings and everything else that I've been doing. And I'm trying to set goals to like, see if we can raise $1 million for this project. And if we can raise $1 million, I think we projected that if we can sell 150,000 masks, that would supply the curriculum to 300 schools, just over 300 schools for free, schools that don't have funding. And that would impact the lives of over 165,000 kids. That's crazy. But that's not even $1 million. Like, to hit $1 million, we'd probably have to sell closer to 200,000 to 300,000 masks. But if we did that, we're pushing up to, you know, 600 schools and 300,000 plus kids that are now, you know, learning how to just treat other people as a human and be accepting, you know?
Yeah, that's a very worthy mission there, you know? It's a good angle of where to put the focus. So cool. That's kind of a good foundation of like what HAPI is and what you're trying to do with HAPI. What's that acronym stand for again? HAPI.
Oh yeah, we should have covered that right away. So HAPI is actually spelled HAPI, and it stands for Humanity, Acceptance, Progress, and then I want that to be highlighted as social progress, and then intersectionality. And those are the ideals of HAPI, you know, as they are. And that's kind of like, that's like the, you know, the goal of raising the money. But on top of that, actually, what I'm trying to do with HAPI, and I'm calling it now Create HAPI, as more of like a call to action. And what I'd like to try to move forward with this is to create a space that can facilitate positive growth and change in our current culture, but also fund the education of the rising generation so that they don't have to deal with everything that, you know, our generation has like ruined and kind of put everyone else through. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it even comes back to you talking about the fact that you didn't want to tell your friends that you sewed because you feared ridicule. And in our generation, and I think we were not I think every generation before us was the same way. It was just sort of normalized that like kids are mean and kids are mean to each other and kids ridicule each other for different things. I just had my friend Kelsey on to talk about fat phobia, and we kind of understood together that like I was like, oh my God, my body issues that I still have to this day as an adult stem from my childhood, like just not just me personally getting made fun of, but also like participating in the mockery of other people, and watching people get mocked and being like, I don't want to be that person who's getting mocked. And the fact that we've just sort of accepted that as a society as that's just how kids are. Kids are dumb. And when they grow up, they'll realize how to be nicer. It's like, well, but some of them will realize how to be nicer, but some of them will just carry that whole childhood of like trauma and turn it into this sort of like thickened defensive skin that turns them into the manipulators and the abusers of the future that then pass that manipulation and trauma down to their kids and continue the cycle of abuse. So why have we just sort of accepted it as school's just where you go to cut your teeth and get bullied and go through this rough stuff? And I don't know, it almost seems like this idea of empathy is like an adult's game, that like empathy is something you learn once you've gone through enough of your own bullying and your own like process, like as an adult, then you gain empathy. And it's like, yeah, hopefully, but could we maybe potentially start trying to teach empathy at an earlier point? And
yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's ideally what we're trying to do, is teach that empathy. And like, and I mean, on top of that, you know, just making sure that kids have that idea where they can accept other cultures or other ideas of society. Yeah, I mean, I can see that as being a pretty awesome future if we can make it happen.
Yeah, I think even as recently as like my nephew graduated high school in like, I want to say like 2018, 2017, 2018. And when he was like 11 to 15 or 16, he was heavily into ballet. And I'm not speaking for him right now when I say this, but I think that part of the reason that sort of petered off was that there was just sort of this decision when he got into high school of like, is this going to fly socially? Is this going to be something I can work with? I don't know. But I'm just saying it's still like this thing of like, why would that ever be a problem that that someone is just fantastic at this thing? Like, who the hell cares what you're good at? I even think that there was a part of me in high school who like didn't want to be thought of as just like a theater kid. You know, I wanted to be more than just a theater kid. But it's like, good luck hiding that, Austin. Like, who doesn't know that you're doing all of the plays? Like, who at this school is unaware that, you know, yeah, like, you don't, it's interesting the different ways that we come up with to other each other when everyone belongs to some othered box. And
yeah,
the unifying thing is that like, we all have our own different things that we're interested in. And we all have it like to try to make something like the coolest thing to be interested in. And of course there's those things like, you know, being in a band or being a skateboarder or being a football player or, you know, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I feel like, I mean, even now in our current generation, you're like, we're not in high school anymore. And I feel like a lot of those ideas are still super pervasive where it's like, oh, well, what do you do? Like, is that cool? Like, you know, like there's kind of this weird, you know, people categorize you in like a level of worth by maybe what you look like or what you do. And I don't know, instead of seeing each other just as humans, it's kind of, I feel like it's just divisive.
Oh, it absolutely continues into the adult sphere of like asking people what they do and instantly internalizing a judgment of that person based on like how monetarily successful they've been or how lucrative their career choice is or how like pragmatic they seem about like how they're going about taking care of their bills and things like that. And it's like, you don't really know anything about anyone based on them telling you, oh, I do this, you know, but like everyone thinks they instantly know everything about me if they hear that I'm an actor or something like that. And I'm like, you have no idea. But, and, you know, in many respects, I'm like, yeah, you might be right. Like, you might be right about, like where I sit in the tax bracket and like what kind of, you know, neuroses I have. But yeah, it's such a weird thing that we carry into our adult space still. So I really do think that empathy is such a key thing in getting us to a place where we can where understanding that just accepting someone's basic humanity, you know, those first two humanity acceptance, first two letters of the thing, just accepting our own humanity and other people's humanity and other people's journeys as their journey, which is separate from ours. And like being able to empathize that people are on their own journey that's colored by their own experience, that's necessary before you can truly grasp the basic tenets of a simple rule like don't be a dick. So here's my question for you. Is there anything that happened, maybe it's one thing or maybe it's a series of things that happened in your life that made you sort of realize or more open to wanting to be able to be involved in this kind of work?
Yeah. So, interestingly enough, like, and I'm going to be super frank about who I've been and kind of unapologetic. Mm-hmm. Well, actually super apologetic. That's actually what I'm going to be.
But straightforward and honest. Yeah.
Yeah. Straightforward and honest. So my entire life I've thought, man, I am just like, I'm an okay dude. Like I'm not, you know, going out of my way to hurt anybody. I'm super supportive. Like growing up, my favorite cousin was black. Mm-hmm. you know? And because of him, I wanted to learn to play the piano. He played the piano and it was beautiful. And I was like, dang, I'm going to learn to play the piano, you know?
Yeah.
And when I was 13, my sister came out as gay and I was like, cool. I love you. I mean, you are low key my favorite sister, but this is awesome. So, and so my entire life, I've kind of been in this space of like, people are people and that's okay. And I didn't really, in my mind, see that there was a difference in color or, you know, any of these like social injustices. I didn't see them. And, you know, you and I grew up in the same community.
Yeah.
We were in like a predominantly white religious community that was, I feel like, you know, like the education and the influence that we had was pretty uniform to just, you know, you are who you are and you're going to grow up this way. And we didn't really see that many like cross-cultural kind of interactions.
We didn't grow up in a diverse area. We had people from different walks of life that we went to school with, but our school was overwhelmingly homogenized, and it was homogenized religiously, racially, and it is a symptom of white privilege to be able to live to have an existence where you don't have to think about intersectionality and how the world is for people in different tax brackets and stuff like that. That's a like part of having privilege. And it's like, you're off to such a great start with the story because so many well-meaning white people who think of themselves as like not a problematic person, as a person who acknowledges the humanity of other people. It's the story starts this way where it's like, I'm not mean to anyone. I'm not going out of my way to like invalidate anyone's experience. I'm just minding my own business. But it is that like unconscious ignorance of the wealth of diversity that actually surrounds you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I've gone, you know, the majority of my life, just I think the best way to say it is ignorant and complacent. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I would see stories of like really shitty things that happened. And I would think, yeah, that's a one-off. Because I was in more or less a cultural bubble. And I kind of was complacent where I was. And I didn't actually push myself to explore and try to, you know, see what was going on outside of that and accept the reality. So, I mean, there are a lot of things, so many things that kind of have impacted me to want to get involved with this and like have more empathy and create empathy. But there's one story that kind of that I think was relatively recent that I think kind of communicates it a little bit. And it also kind of shows how slow my brain was to change for a really long time. But this one night, my fiance and I, we had a couple drinks, and I also don't recommend doing this ever, by the way, but we had a couple drinks, and then we, for some reason, I don't know how we got on the topic, but we had a discussion and we decided to bring up like women's rights and like white privilege and more specifically white male privilege. Mm-hmm. And like you were saying, you know, we're in the way that I grew up, I'm like, man, I have been a good guy and all of this other stuff. And my fiance was trying to say like, that isn't the point. And I wasn't hearing her and I was getting really defensive.
Yes.
Because that's what happens is we think, man, we're good people. I'm going to defend the fact that I'm a good person.
Right.
I don't remember 100% of the conversation because I mean, you know, it was emotional and things went all over the place, but eventually she started giving me examples of like, do you look in your car before you get in it ever? I was like, no, why would I do that? She's like, well, what if somebody's in there and they attack you? It's like, nobody's going to do that. And she's like, yeah, cause you're a dude. And I'm like, yeah, I mean like, yeah, that seems like a no-brainer idea, but at the same time, it's super relevant. Like she has to be a little more scared when she walks down the street. And realistically, because of like the white male privilege and the perception of women, she has to work X amount harder at work to be recognized and relevant.
Yeah.
Now, a little background on my fiance. She's got her master's in engineering. Mm-hmm. Within three, you know, like her first job out of college, within 3 years, she's been promoted to a manager. She's incredibly successful. She's amazing. And I admire her like so much, but I also see how hard she has to work to get where she's at. And it's astounding. Like it's astonishing. I feel like I work pretty hard, but I don't end up, you know, like I don't feel like I have to work as hard as her sometimes. And it's crazy. And that's the reality of white male privilege. Mm-hmm. And you can see that in so many different like socioeconomic areas. Like if you ask, you know, if you go into a black neighborhood and you're like, okay, why is everyone here black? You know, not a lot of people can answer that question, but it's because the economy and like the history of what we've taught people, like how to regard black people, is that they are less trustworthy. You know, they don't work as hard. There's all of this dogma that is absolute garbage, right?
It's historic, systemic, institutionalized racism from the foundation of the country, and it still exists today. And white people, we swim in the water of privilege, and fish don't recognize the water they're swimming in. So it's literally just your fiance saying, do you check the backseat of your car? And you're like, no, we don't think about these things.
No,
but when you actually sit down to look at it, and it's so easy to oversimplify the explanation, just like, I know why the black people live in that neighborhood, because they're lazy. And if they wanted to live in my neighborhood, they could work hard for it and get it. And it's like, that's such a ridiculous, self-preserving, oversimplified way of looking at it. But it is it's just easier. It's just more comfortable than actually looking at how,
And like you just said, you know, like that idea of if I work hard, I will be successful is very pervasive. And in America, what's amazing is that that statement at its base value, yes, is true. If I work hard, I can be successful. And what we're missing in this key, and I think the reason we're not empathizing, like where we're lacking when we say, if you work hard, you'll be successful, you know, like, man, if you know, I'm a white dude. Like I can only speak to what I've read and researched and like, and what I do know. If I had to work as hard as someone of color to get to where I was, I would have had to work like 200 to 300% harder than what I did because people perceive me differently. Like if equality was actually like relevant and prevalent in society, we would see so many more people of color or women in leadership positions because they work their asses off and they do incredible things and they're geniuses and they're smart. But because of the systemic racism and the way that, you know, like society has chosen to like, I don't know, spray all of this bad information out there, they're perceived differently and rewarded differently, which means that equality doesn't actually exist.
Yeah, not at all. And when we talk about equality, it's like, you know, a common like apologist argument will be like, well, no, equality doesn't actually exist. No one's equal. No one's born equal. People are born with different abilities and different advantages. And that's just the reality of the world. And it's like, yeah, of course, we're not talking about like making people equally abled or like what we're talking about is equality of opportunity. And, exactly. And a lot of people think that we do have equality of opportunity. They think that, you know, you can't guarantee, like Jordan Peterson and Ben Shapiro will talk about how you can't guarantee equality of outcomes. All you can do is offer equality of opportunity. And if people aren't taking advantage of the equality of opportunity that exists, it's their own fault. But it's a lie that we have equality of opportunity, and there's not equality of born in advantages and systemic advantages. Like we have a massively unequal system of systemic advantages. And this also doesn't mean that poor white people won't exist. Because that's another thing people like to look at is like, well, then how come there's like my family, I was raised in a trailer park. Like you saying I was privileged. It's like, it doesn't guarantee that just because you're white, that you're going to be a millionaire. That's not what this is about. This is about a system of institutional foundational biases that work in the favor of people who look like you. And that's why the majority of the world's wealth is owned by people who look like you. And yeah, now that we're trying to level the playing field, what's happening, and I had this question asked to me today, a person that I did an interview with earlier today, after we were done with the interview, asked me, she was like, and she's a woman of color, but she said, how do you manage to be so, she's like, you're so not fragile, Austin. Like, you're so like confident and not racist. She's like, how are you the way that you are? And I was like, oh, you're giving me way too much credit here. I was like, I need to be honest with you and be real with you. And since we're talking honesty, Joey, I was very similar to you. I was like, I went through a rough patch of like almost getting fully red pilled on the internet, where I got really into people like Jordan Peterson and people like Ben Shapiro, because, and people like Steven Crowder, and you know, like I, and this is what's happening to a lot of white men on the internet right now, is they're not liking being the bad guys in the narratives that they're seeing. They're not liking this narrative that they've done something wrong and they need to take a look at themselves in the mirror, because they have this narrative in their head, like you just said, of, I didn't do anything. I've been a nice person my whole life. I hold the door open for people. I speak respectfully to everyone, regardless of what their abilities are, or what the color of their skin is, or whether or not I perceive them to be a different sexuality than myself. Like, I treat people with respect. And so internally they think, why am I being villainized in these narratives that I'm seeing? What needs to happen is you need to go all the way through that process and flip the switch to realizing you've been feeling for like 5 minutes what people have been feeling generationally over the course of several hundreds of years. What an entire like group of people, like black people have been put into narrative boxes that have held them back from success for hundreds of years. And the narrative keeps shifting to whatever it needs to shift to continue the status quo. So you just talked about it, like the narrative of, you know, God, I just talked to a guy online who's still saying that IQ is a racial definer, that like people of different races have certain IQs. And he was like talking to me about phrenology and skull shape and bone density. And I was like, these narratives. So if you're a white guy and you're feeling like every time I look at the news, all I'm seeing is this narrative that white, straight, cis men are the enemy. It's like, yeah, you might be seeing a little bit of that narrative, but also like, take a step back from feeling hurt by that narrative. Ask yourself why you're seeing that narrative. Ask yourself if there's any merit to that narrative. Don't make it personal. And then try to step into the experience of anyone other than yourself and see if you're really being treated unfairly here. You know?
So I think that like the most relevant points that you just spoke of is like, don't make it personal.
Yeah.
Because you know what? You're probably still a good dude. You've probably done great things, but that doesn't change the fact that being a white man, you have what's called white male privilege, which is a real thing and exists.
Yeah.
And you just have to accept it and move on. And if you want to make a difference and feel better about yourself, which is, if I'm going to be honest, one of the reasons I started this whole thing was almost like trying to, you know, feel a little bit better about myself is let's try to move the needle forward. Let's try to change this imbalance and actually create what that equality, like that missing equality of opportunity, you know?
Right.
You just have to remove that personal aspect, because they're not attacking you individually. They're saying systemically across the board, this is what it looks like. They're not saying, hey, Austin, you, I'm pointing at you. You're an asshole.
You created this.
You created this shit.
These oppressive systems. It's like, no one's actually saying that, but they are saying that however unconsciously you have been going through the world benefiting from these systems. However unconsciously you've been doing that. And where empathy comes in for me is if I lose an acting job, there's an acting job that says all ethnicities, you know, that's what it says on the breakdown, is we're looking for all ethnicities, and they hire a Latino guy or they hire a black guy for the role. There could be this miffed straight white cis tendency to be like, well, of course they did that. Of course they did the diversity hire because they got like, of course I'm not going to get that job. Or you could just try to think maybe the competition playing field is being leveled and I was outcompeted for that job. If your brain is automatically always going to, it's a diversity hire or it's someone trying to do some kind of affirmative action thing or that person didn't actually earn that job, that's some unchecked internalized racism, my homie G's, that you need to look at. That it's like, why do you assume that a person got a job simply because they were trying to like do some kind of diversity hire? Why are you not capable of thinking maybe they just outcompeted me for that job?
Yeah, and that kind of, what that made me think of is there's a really famous quote by, I think it's like Rabbi, I think it's Hillel. And he says something to the effect of like, if I don't love myself, who will love me? But if I only love myself, what am I? And I feel like that's really pertinent to this conversation, because in the example that you gave, that person is literally just saying, well, this is me. This is an attack on me. I'm loving me. I don't care about these people who are probably really talented and gifted, which is why they got the part. And then they're literally only internalizing everything and looking at themselves and focusing only on themselves instead of opening up to this other experience. But what does that make you? Well, in that situation, it makes you racist. It makes you somebody who is literally just trying not passively, but aggressively portray that, like, you know, these other people don't actually matter.
It's me versus you, you know?
Exactly.
And they'll try to say that, like, nah, you're the real racist. They'll try to call guys like you and me, you know, soy boys who are just trying to, simp for girls and stuff like that. And I'm like, yeah. I promise you it's not that. Like, someone the other day, this guy that was talking to me about phrenology called me a race traitor, and like, I've never been called a race traitor before. Like, this guy was like an old school racist, like an old school like 1700s era racist. But I was like, he kept saying why do you hate your own race, why do you hate yourself? And I was like, oh my guy, I don't. I was like quite the opposite, actually. Like, I don't view myself as like part of the white team. I view myself as a human being, and like, I'm on team human. And for me, like, anything that's hurting the cause of all of us rising together is my enemy. And that's what I need to be fighting against in myself and at large. Like, so I think it's good that you brought up self-love, having to love yourself, because I actually think to be capable of genuine empathy, you have to first do the work to find actual genuine love for yourself, which means being honest with yourself about who you are and forgiving yourself for who you are and for the mistakes that you've made, because then you can be honest with other people about who you are, and you can carry that out. But like, you genuinely can't really offer people genuine empathy if you're not real about who you are and real about loving yourself. And so when this guy's like, why do you hate yourself? I'm like, oh, bud, it's so different from that. Like, you hate yourself. Like, yeah,
100%.
Your self-hatred is projected outward onto others. Quite the opposite for me. I've done the hard work to forgive myself for my past mistakes and for my current mistakes that I make on a daily basis. And I cultivate self-love so that I can show love outward to others.
Exactly. And you actually made me think of yet another quote, which I don't know about you, but I actually love watching RuPaul, the Drag Race.
Love RuPaul.
And at the end, RuPaul always says, if you don't love yourself, how the hell are you going to love somebody else?
Yes.
And it's just so accurate. It's so true. And I love watching RuPaul. The
do you
whole
like,
show, RuPaul,
do you like
amazing.
RuPaul as a tailor? Like, is that like fascinating to you to like watch them?
So, yes, I love watching them like go on there and start sewing their, like, blows my mind that they, because I don't like making dresses.
Yeah.
But damn, if they are not insanely talented. Like, those people are so talented. It blows my mind. And then you watch them dance in this blows my mind. I don't understand.
It is a talent. Have those skills. It's a talent show on many levels. Like it is, there are so many dimensions to that show.
It's crazy.
It's such a fantastic show.
Yeah.
I did a whole episode about drag like 6 months ago. But it always blows us away when people come on the show and they don't know how to sew. Cause we're like, how do you like, and they're always like first challenge. They're like, uh-oh, I don't know how to build clothes. And it's like, you've been watching the show, right? This is like season 14. Like
that, you like literally just,
you
happened.
Must have known that you were going to have to sew at some point. Like,
yeah. No, for real.
Yeah.
But back to that, yeah. Like if you don't love yourself, how are you going to love somebody else?
Yeah.
And everything else. If we go to an evolutionary, you know, standpoint of human beings, humans are social creatures.
Uh-huh.
If we look at research-based studies of individuals versus the group, there's so much relevant information that demonstrates how our levels of happiness and like communication and everything else are directly tied to our own social connections.
Mm-hmm.
And to create those social connections, there's literally no way to do that without empathy. You know, and that empathy, which is the ability to understand and share feelings of others. And I mean, that's why empathy is so, so crucial. And that's kind of the other thing that I'm trying to do with Create Happy. Aside from raise money for the Be Kind Foundation, I'm trying to create a media space where we can have interviews and conversations and an ongoing current conversation for our generation that cultivates a space where people can make those social connections and try to generate more positivity and awareness for everybody else involved.
That's fantastic. I think that's such a great mission. So the last thing I want to cover, and this is a little bit of like, I don't know, this is kind of heavy, and I put this in the notes for you, and I was like, I don't even know if we'll get to it. But I think it's like something to think about, because I think sometimes when, you know, schmaltzy, feely liberals want to say like, love is all we need, or love will lead the way, if people have a tendency to feel like it's a little naive, or like it's a little unrealistic, that like, you know, and it's and it's looking more and more like if any kind of revolution is going to happen in our country, it's going to be some kind of like class war. Like 2020 made people so aware of the fact that like, the government could just print money to help everyone and we could do universal basic income, but we don't. And instead we continue to pass laws that enrich people who are already way, way, way too wealthy, with some kind of hope that like they'll just do good things with their immoral amount of super wealth. And so the question basically is like, is love enough and is empathy enough? And can we truly create a world in the future where like, we have a more egalitarian society, a more understanding, compassionate, humane society? Can we do that? Or is some kind of violent conflict always going to be a part of the stew? And that's a big question. So I don't expect you to like know the answer, but like take a shot at it.
You know what? So believe it or not, when you sent me that you're probably going to be asking that question, I got really excited. So, and I might geek out for like just 1 second on,
yeah, go ahead.
On this. So the first thing that, and I don't think that I have the answer to this question first. I'd like to clarify that. Like,
yeah,
I don't
do I.
think I have this answer, but I do, however, have hopes.
Yeah.
And those hopes are based on past events, modern research, and literally just me trying to project hope out there into the world.
Yeah.
So I love reading books. I read a ridiculous amount, and maybe something that can be kind of relevant to why I'm gonna, there's a lot of books and people I'm gonna reference. And what's relevant to that is when I was 12 to 13 years old, I was actually diagnosed as a child, manic depressive.
Uh-huh.
And most people in my life would not think, oh man, Joey, you seem like somebody who's depressed. And I, you know, most people in their lives who are depressed, I don't think the people in their lives necessarily always know. And again, this isn't saying like, you know, depression, there's like a specific way to get over it, whatnot. I have days that are crushing, but
yeah.
When I was young, I had a great opportunity where my mom found books on positive psychology that I was able to read and really get into, and it really helped me personally change things around. And so positive psychology is pretty fascinating. And on top of that, like, you go into really ancient, kind of cool, just fun books to read that are kind of philosophical.
Yeah.
And like in The Art of War, Sun Tzu, he says, like, supreme excellence consists of breaking the enemy's resistance without fighting.
Oh.
And he's got another one that's like it's really cool the way that he phrases it. It's something like the supreme art of war is to subdue the enemy without fighting. And I think those are both like kind of cool to hear and think about. But then on top of that, when I personally look back into the history of what's been going on, and I think about the most influential movements or people in the history of fighting oppression and everything else and civil rights, I mean, two people immediately come to mind. We've got Gandhi and we've got Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah.
And they were both activists who were nonviolent, and they made crazy, resounding, lasting impacts on the world and society at large. Like on a world scale almost, you know?
Yeah.
And they were nonviolent. And I mean, violence came out because for some reason people hate the idea of being equal. I don't understand that, but people like that, you know, they're out there and they exist. But when I think about violence, and this is again me, like I can't conjure up feelings of like positivity when I think about violence. I always think like, ew, scary, negative, like I don't like the idea of that. And it also kind of brings to mind the idea of a term that I think we've all used, which is vicious cycle.
Yeah.
You know, we know what a vicious cycle is. It's like a negative feedback loop. It just,
right,
boom, boom, boom. And then you just spiral on downwards. And
cycle
so,
of abuse. Yeah.
Yeah. Cycle of abuse. And so when I think about violence, and there's another phrase, it's like violence begets violence.
Right.
And what's crazy is science has actually proven that that is true.
Yeah.
Violence does beget violence.
And also fire begets fire.
Ooh, fire begets fire.
You know, they've actually been able to show that fire makes more fire. And that
that's true.
The opposite of fire puts fire out.
Crazy, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, like, so if violence does beget violence, like as humans, there's an interesting phenomenon that they've studied that what is in front of us will imitate and mirror.
Yeah. Yeah.
We all do it. Uh-huh. And so if we see the violence and then it just causes more, but if that's true, then why can't the reverse be true? Where positivity and love, and I love the Beatles, by the way, sorry, I just had to remember that reference.
Yeah.
Positivity and love. Why can't that then create more? And I think that's kind of what like Martin Luther King Jr. did with his example. Instead of creating a vicious cycle, he created something that we could call like a virtuous cycle, where it's a positive feedback loop that made a change because there were so many people that backed it and saw the relevance and got behind it. And I think that if we can, as a community, somehow create that cohesiveness, we can create like a positive feedback loop. But the things that we've got fighting against us on that is that, like, again, back to like our normal, you know, our genetics and our evolution, is that we've evolved to focus on the negative. If we didn't evolve that way, then we would have died out forever ago. Like when we're cavemen, we had to focus on all those negative things around us, because if we didn't see that tiger, it was going to kill us.
Yeah.
And so
greed is evolutionary. I need all the nuts. I need more nuts than my neighbor because I need to store up all the nuts for winter. I just need as many as me and my family need. And that's as many as I can possibly get, to the point there's no limit to how much I need. And now we've got this problem of having like an entire class of people who have so much wealth, they don't even know what to do with it. And they just keep getting more exponentially every year. And they're so confused as to what to do with it that they just buy another yacht, buy another house, buy another. And it's just kind of like, at some point, it's like, stop with that. When there's billions of people who can barely afford food, stop it. But evolutionarily, like they're, you know, they're trained.
Exactly. So I mean, and there are scientists that refer to that as the old brain versus the new brain.
Yeah.
Where there's like that old brain where these instincts are just embedded in us. And like, we have to do that. And it's like, but at the same time, we've got this new brain, this cognitive brain that can think. And there's a lot of research that shows that like positive psychology and everything else can create, if we just use a little bit in our own lives, it creates more productivity and like success in individual lives. But it takes a lot of work, because they've also shown that to balance out like positive, negative, you need a ratio of 3-1 positive to negative. So do I think that we can do it peacefully? I think so. I just think that we have to come together, you know, as humans and do our best and create an ecosystem that kind of cultivates those ideals and try to make it into like a positive feedback loop. I think it's going to take an insane amount of work, but I also think it's possible.
Yeah, I, for one, choose to agree with you. I'm on the same page where I'm like, I don't actually know the answer to this question. History and all of human history tells me that violent conflict will always be a part, play some role in social change. But my personal experience in my life is that these things are possible if you let them be. And if you like, if you choose to allow them to be, and like, I don't know, like I work a program that's full of all these little simple sayings, you know, like one day at a time, we get better one day at a time, progress, not perfection. We practice progress, not perfection. We're not perfect at this stuff. We're going to continue to make mistakes, but we're trying to progress in a positive direction, you know? And one of my favorite things that the program says that I'm like, because it's so straightforward and like simple, but also profound, is it works if you work it. So in other words, I encounter people all the time who say, I did the AA thing, or I did the 12-step thing, like didn't work for me. And I'm like, well, it's not like that. It's not like some people it works for them, some people it doesn't. It works if you work it, which means if you show up to meetings every day and make phone calls to other people in the program every day and find ways to be of service every day, we believe that you will not return to drinking and using. And it seems simple, but it's remarkably difficult. It's a remarkably difficult thing for a lot of people to grasp. But it's kind of like, I remember like listening to people debate about why Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders couldn't be the candidate for the Democratic Party. And they would always say this phrase where they'd say, I don't think that they're electable. And it would baffle me, because I would think, well, a person is electable if we decide they are. If we all choose to vote for them, then they're electable. But if we all say, that person's not electable, that person can't win, it's like, hey, look, we're picking a candidate to go up against Donald Trump. We're picking one person. Whoever we pick, we're all just going to understand, like, we got to vote for that person. I didn't want it to be Joe Biden. I think I know a lot of people who he wasn't their first choice. But I happily went to the polls or filled out my ballot and voted for Joe Biden, because I was determined that it could no longer be that person who it was. And so it's the power of will to be like, when someone says, "Oh, we can't do it that way. That person's not going to win." That it's like, "Well, but we're in charge of the decision, right?" So if the question is to me, can love and empathy work? It's like, yes, if we do it. And so I choose to be with you and say, like, absolutely, it can work if we choose to go with that method, you know?
And sorry, not to get too sciencey on you again, but like, a fascinating fact about our brains is every single second we perceive and we take in 11 million bits of data every single second.
Yeah.
But we only actually process 40 bits of those.
Mm-hmm. Unless you're doing LSD, and then you process like a little bit more.
When you were talking with Sean, I listened to that podcast. Yeah. it opens up the filter. You're processing so much more.
A little bit more data comes through.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. But go on with the point.
But that means that there's 40 bits of data out of 11 million bits that you are choosing to perceive.
Yeah.
Which means that there are multiple possible real, true emotional realities out there.
Yes.
And you're only choosing one of them.
Uh-huh.
So we actually do have to make that conscious choice of like, yes, I will see that that is a true reality. Because, I mean, a great example of a true reality, like if you ever see those like 3D boxes, like the two squares and whatnot. Yep. And if you look at it long enough, the face of the box switches.
Sure.
There's two realities of that box. Mm-hmm. Now
There's three realities. Because it's also just a flat drawing, which is
exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. See, so even there, you like, if you think about it, there's more to it.
Yeah.
But the problem with that example is that all realities are equal. And that's not a fact. That's just not truth. But there can be thousands of true realities that we just have to actually, we've got to pick the one that creates a positive outcome, and we got to fight for it.
Yeah.
And that's really it.
I mean, on a personal level, it's like one of the most dangerous things for me as a person in recovery is when I have a justified resentment. And so this is something that can, you know, lead to violent conflict, or whether it's physical violence or verbal violence, is when I have a justified resentment with someone. Someone has done me wrong, and I feel, as I process it in my brain and I go over the scenario, that I am clearly right and they are clearly wrong. It's very easy for me to get lost down a rabbit hole of going after that person and stewing in negative emotion about that person, because I have been able to convince myself that it is true that that person deserves my negativity and that this situation warrants my anger and my frustration. So justified resentments are really scary for me. And when I work with newcomers and guys on this, it's like one of the toughest things for them to get is like, we need to be able to let go of justified resentment and actually pray for the people that we're mad about and send love and light to those people. And it's like, that's a really difficult concept, because when I'm convinced and when my ego is convinced that I have been wronged, I can really talk myself into a slew of bad decisions that eventually will lead me to a place of like, I'm gonna lose my sobriety over that. And I can't afford that. But that's on a personal level. If you extrapolate that out to a societal level, it's when entire groups of people feel justified in acting from a place of anger toward another group of people that we go toward inevitable violent conflict. And finding a place on a one-to-one level where you can accept the reality that simultaneously it can be true that maybe an argument could be made that that person has caused you legitimate harm and that that person needs to go through some process of accountability for themselves. But like for you, the individual who was harmed, holding on to that resentment and hanging in that place of justified resentment is only going to poison your heart and take you further away from a place of love and empathy. And all of us as a society, if we can recognize that we can't afford that, that we can't afford that like space where we're like, but I'm right about this. That person is wrong and I'm right. And they deserve whatever they have coming to them. It's like, that to me is what's going to lead us to inevitable violent conflict every single time.
And that I think would lead to inevitable violence, but hopefully, and I know that I'm probably biting off more than I can chew, but that's why I'm surrounding myself with people smarter than me, like you and, you know, our good friend Sean, or the Be Kind Academy people. You know, I'm trying to find people that maybe know better than I do. But with Create Happy, I'd like to create that media culture, like a cultural hub, a place where you can go and understand that there is another true reality. Because what you just described, those people are picking true points of data.
Yes.
And they're choosing that that is their reality.
Yes.
But there are other true points of data that do not need to cause conflict. And hopefully with Create Happy, you know, like on the social scale and not just raising money for the education, we can, you know, create more positive points and try to influence a little bit more, even on a smaller scale, to let people know, you know, like, we can do this.
Well, I absolutely love these like like choosing which point of data you're going to lean into, because typically for me, my first reaction is really hard to control. My first reaction will be frustration or anger or indignation. How dare they speak to me that way? How dare that person cut me off? Whatever it is, like my knee-jerk reaction is entitled and self-centered and ego-driven 99% of the time. What I'm working on through careful practice, one day at a time, and self-love and meditation, is to be able to have that first reaction and then go, so it may be true that that person wasn't looking and they just cut me off and were driving very dangerously. Maybe true. It can be simultaneously true that I can make an evaluation of, like, will my life and my day today be better if I spend my day in that state of hanging on to my justified anger, or if I allow myself to think, you know, I probably do that from time to time. Sometimes I cut people off because I just didn't see them there. You know, I was distracted, and it was certainly not personal. And that person, that person is having their own journey and they're in their own experience. Which one of those options and those truths is going to result in me having a more enlightened experience that day?
And that is an amazing example of, you chose a reality that made you a better person, which means that, like, if you're having a better day and you can smile and you can laugh more, you're releasing dopamine, which improves your productivity and creativity and everything else. But then at the same time, like, what I'd love to point out is that, how did you make that decision? What tool did you employ? Empathy.
Yep.
That's what you did. You thought about that other person and then you related to them on some level, and you're like, hey, we are social. We're not that different. You're a human. I'm a human. Right. We both mess up.
Right.
And if we can do that individually on a consistent level, I think, like, every time you get in a positive conversation where empathy is involved, you're just circulating more and more of that love and empathy.
Yeah.
And if we can continue to circulate it, who knows? Maybe we can make a difference where violence doesn't have to be an outcome. And, you know, in 20 years, when all of us are just kind of like, you know, trying to figure it out, and we're dead, maybe, you know, in 30, 40 years, and the next generation, they don't have these problems because they've been educated properly and they didn't have to go through this.
Ooh, what a thought.
Empathy, man.
What a thought. I love it. That's a solid place, I think, to end it. That's a good conversation, and I really appreciate it. I'm excited for the launch of Happy, and I hope that you sell 5 million masks. And
that would be crazy. And I hope I can produce that many.
Get this Be Kind curriculum into as many schools as possible. And I hope you have to make all 5 million of those masks by yourself, from scratch, and that you really just, like, get in there and do that all, you know, from your garage. And
epic. That would be quite wild.
Epic. Yeah. No, but I appreciate you taking the time. And is there anything else you wanted to say before we sign off here?
Yeah, just thank you. I appreciate your time. You I admire what you do as a creator, and I think that, you know, that empathy and positivity that we just spoke of, I just want to say I really think that you emulate that really well. And I just want to say thank you, and that, like, I just admire you as a human. You're awesome, man.
Oh, same to you. Right back at you. Mutual admiration. Thank you very much. That makes me feel good, and I appreciate it. It's been nice reconnecting with you over the last few weeks.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Cool. Well, we'll talk soon, man.
Thanks
so much. Have a nice day.
You see ya.
Later. That was really, really nice. Nice to talk with him. He's an old friend, and it's been nice to catch up with him as I've been helping him sort of with the rollout of this thing. But I'm proud of him. I'm proud that he wants to utilize his business savvy and his know-how to do something positive. I think it's really, really good. And I think that we need people like that, who are like people who know how to make something successfully, and who know how to structure a business, but who want to do something impactful for society at the same time. That's good stuff, and I really liked where we got to in that discussion. talking about sort of our own personal journeys to realizing that empathy was a really simple but like also really all-encompassing tool to help us be more compassionate people. Okay, it's time now to turn it over to you, the listeners, in a segment that I'm thinking of putting a stinger here. I'm not going to do it on this episode, but like, don't be surprised if next week there's a stinger. I have a new thing to call this segment, and I'm sure someone else has called their own lives and their own talkbacks on TikTok something like this before, but I'm calling it the TikTok. Talk spelled T-A-L-K. How good is that? It's the TikTok. Every Sunday, I record the intro and outro of this podcast that you're listening to right now, live on TikTok. I'm live on TikTok right now. There's people literally asking me questions right now. And this is the TikTok. So let's go to the questions. Slayer Key asks, how do we do empathy and call out people on their stuff? That's a really good question. I don't necessarily think that being empathetic and recognizing that people are coming from a set of lived experiences and circumstances that may be different from your own but are also similar to yours, and that like you didn't necessarily choose where you were born or who your parents were or like what kinds of experiences you had that formed your worldview, and that's the same as they didn't really choose that for themselves. I don't think that recognizing that means that you don't correct people or encourage people to try harder or do better when we feel like they're being, you know, racist or problematic or clinging to views that are harmful. But I think that empathy can actually be used as a tool to have those conversations in a more effective way. I think if you're utilizing empathy and recognizing that this is a person who is coming at this perspective from a series of lived experiences and having that sort of compassion for where they're coming from, you have a better chance at communicating that correction or that call out or that call in. If you listen to last week's episode, Regina Aquino, and people have talked about it in this comment thread before, calling it a call in instead of a call out. You have a better shot at calling someone in if you're approaching them with empathy and compassion than just vitriol and judgment. And I'm nowhere near perfect on this. I fuck up on this all the time. People in my comment sections all the time invoke my wrath and my my vitriol and my judgment, and I just don't have time or patience to be empathetic with them and compassionate with them. And I don't think that I'm very effective in those scenarios. In fact, I'm fairly certain I'm not. And I'm not even trying to be effective. I'm just trying to let that person know that I really don't have the time to try to be nice to them and that I don't like what they said. And while it can be short-term satisfying to me to sort of like rage dunk on someone, it actually is long-term, like usually disappointing. Like I'm not happy that I wasn't able to approach that person with a little bit more patience and acceptance and empathy. And so I think having empathy for people doesn't mean that you give them a pass. I don't think that it's a free pass to do whatever you want and that you just say, well, I empathize with your position and therefore I agree with it. I think that empathy can be used as a tool to have more effective conversations where you're trying to call someone in on problematic behavior. Great question. Thank you. Ashley Kaneen? It's Ashley K-N-E-E-N. How do y'all think that's said? I'm going to say Neen. Ashley Neen says, how do I keep a good relationship with my family who have completely different views? I have experience with this. patience is a good thing to remember. I live in a family of divided fundamental views. My family at this point is almost split right down the middle when it comes to our fundamental viewpoints on God and religion and spirituality and politics. And I mean, not necessarily politics. We almost unilaterally agree that Donald Trump is sucks. And so I actually, boy, I really feel for people who that's the situation in their family, because that is that's a tough one right now. That's a tough bridge to gap. But yeah, for the last 15 years in my life, my family and I, and lots of my close friends that I grew up with and went to high school with, have had starkly different beliefs and opinions on really like fundamental matters that people kind of use their structure of like who God is and what God is as like a very fundamental identifier and a piece of who they are. And it seems like it's almost impossible to like get along with or understand people who fundamentally disagree with you on that stuff. What was really useful for me in my experience was patience. Early on, it was hard, you know? When I first stepped away from Mormonism and when I first stopped believing the same things that all the people who around me believed when I was growing up, it was hard, you know? It was hard for them. It was hard for me. They didn't understand where I was coming from, and I was really angry that no one was trying to understand me or asking me the questions that I wanted to be asked or trying to get inside why I thought the way that I thought. So there's frustration on both sides. They didn't understand why I was doing what I was doing. It seemed kind of like hurtful, or like what had happened. Like, some people thought I was like losing my mind, or they'd say like, oh, he's falling off the deep end, you know? And that was hurtful to me. It was tough. It was a good several years of like, you know, having a hard time coming to a space of understanding. So patience is one thing, knowing that most things in life are transient, and that time is a great healer and corrector of many things. Not all things. Some people have rifts in their families and in their relationships with friends that never get repaired. And so I'm not saying that, you know, give it a few months, a few years, and everything will be better. But time is one thing, and asking for patience, because the reason why I need to ask for patience with other people is because I need patience with myself. Usually when I'm frustrated that it's taking other people a while to get something that I want them to get, it's usually indicative that I'm also frustrated with myself that it took me so long to get something, or that it's taking me so long to get something. I have a lot of issues right now that with the fact that like, I know I feel better on a day-to-day basis when I meditate in the morning. I know that my day goes smoother when I meditate and pray, and I have to fight myself every single morning to do that simple thing. And so in that struggle, I have to try to find patience for myself. Like, it's frustrating being like, you know that you feel better if you do this thing, why don't you do it? And I get really frustrated with myself. And it's a similar frustration that I get with other people, that it's like, you can see that this is the issue, right? Like, why aren't you getting that? And as long as I need patience with myself, I'm gonna need patience with others. So, I don't know. It's difficult. It's not easy work. You know, a lot of this stuff is uncomfortable and difficult. A big part of the conversation that we had last week on the show with Regina Aquino and Chance Aquino was like doing difficult, uncomfortable work, trusting people with difficult, uncomfortable conversations, and trying to lead in those conversations with compassion and empathy, I think is like your best shot. Again, to sort of reiterate that point, I hope that was a decent answer to your question. I feel like I could go really, really deep on that one, but I'm going to move on. I hope that was like at least a decent surface level attempt. And thank you for that question. Sarah Smart. Hey, Sarah. We like seeing you in here week after week. Thank you for always being here. Says, how do you teach people to be empathetic? That's a good question. You know, I think that's actually a really good question for like, what is the curriculum going to look like that Happy hopes to craft with the Be Kind Project that they hope to put into schools? Like, what is that going to look like? I don't actually have the particulars on like what their specific curriculum is going to look like. I know that in my personal life, the best way for me to learn empathy is through some kind of process where I'm trying to work on myself. Julie Archer, the goat, my mom, in the comment says, by example. That's a very good way. Very good answer, Julie. By example, showing people what empathy looks like, showing them how it can be utilized and how it can be a force for good, how it can help you in your own life. But for me, the best way that I learned empathy and the best way that I continue to learn empathy is by working on myself. The more that I'm working on myself and the more that I'm trying to unpack my bullshit and work on my shortcomings and my character defects, the more I realize that I am in dire need of empathy from others. And as long as I know that I'm in dire need of empathy from others, I can see how my need for that and my need for other people to be patient with me and to try to understand me will help, will inform my being empathetic with other people. Boy, that was a tough sentence for me to say. But I hope that makes sense, that working on myself teaches me the importance of empathy, teaches me that when I'm listening to people and trying to relate to people, relating with them is always a better solution for me than judging them. Leaning into what they're saying always works better for me than pulling away. Trying to push through my discomfort with what a person is saying. How do you teach that? It's kind of one of those things that you have, like doing work, being engaged in some kind of process, whether it's therapy, whether it's a 12-step program, whether it's just like a meditative practice, being engaged in some kind of process where you're trying to better yourself and bolster up your mental and spiritual health, I think you can't help but see the benefit and the use and the practicality of empathy. Okay, cool. Yeah, Ashley Neen just said, I just had that conversation with my immediate family, and it was a very one-sided conversation. So again, I go back to patience, because it's not going to work all the time. It's not going to work right off the bat. It's not going to be like, I'm going to approach this thing with compassion and empathy, and I'm going to like... So something I learned early on from the program that I work is that I'm in the actions business, not the results business. I take actions like trying to approach people with empathy and compassion, and I need to get out of the business of expecting a specific result. It's kind of the thing of like, like nice guys who are like, I'm a nice guy. How come girls reject me? And it's like, well, you have to be a nice person without the expectation of a specific result. You have to practice empathy and compassion in these conversations and let go of the expectation that if I'm going to do this, you also better be super nice to me and empathetic to me. That would be lovely if every time we practiced empathy with people that we disagree with, they were like, wow, like, thank you so much for putting it that way. No one's ever put it like that. That's amazing. That's not usually how it goes down. And we have to utilize empathy to understand that people are on their own process, that they're in their own experience, and that they're having their own experience, that what you think you said and the tone that you said it and the way that it came out, that person is processing it through their own lens and through their own place in their own journey. So again, utilizing empathy to understand that they might not be far enough along in their journey to take in what you've just offered to them and to take it in the spirit that it was offered. They might not be there. And so continuing to just offer it in that spirit and knowing that they might never get there, but utilizing that empathy to understand that that person is just where they are. You know, they're just where they are. And there's no way to really know exactly what kind of work they're doing when you're not around. But yeah, it's tough. It's difficult. I think that's all the questions we have for the podcast portion, for the TikTok. Stay on the live. We'll keep hanging out. I'm going to wrap the podcast up. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to my website, austin-archer.com, or you can buy my music at austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com. Look up Austin Archer wherever you stream music. Most of my albums are on there. My music and the podcast is mixed and mastered by Chris Bjorn over at Marmalade Music. Go to themarmalademusic.com. and tell Chris that you listen to People Pleaser, and he's going to give you 20% off of your first project. So if you've got a podcast, a song, a album that you want to record that you need mixed and mastered, Marmalade Music is the best in the biz. Tell him that I sent you for 20% off your first project. The TikTok portion of our show is moderated by Sweet Mama J, Jennifer. Jennifer, I didn't get your last name. So for this episode, it's just going to be Sweet Mama J. And we thank her so much for that service. We thank you all for being here, for listening week after week. Really love y'all so much. Be nice to each other out there. Be empathetic with each other out there. Wear your masks. Take care of each other. Okay. Love ya. Bye-bye.